This episode features discussions of kidnapping, murder, suicide, sexual assault, and the physical abuse of a child that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
The handwriting was peculiar. The hurried cursive sprawled across a single page, torn from a child's composition book.
Attention. I'm sorry this had to happen, but I am in bad need of money and couldn't get it in any other way. Don't tell anyone or go to the police about this because I am watching you closely. I am scared stiff and will kill the baby at your first wrong move. Just put $2,000, $2,000, in small bills in a brown envelope and place it next to the signpost at the corner of Albemarle Road and Park Avenue at exactly 10 o'clock tomorrow, Thursday morning. If everything goes smooth, I will bring the baby back and leave him on the same corner, safe and happy, at exactly 12 noon. No excuses. I can't wait. Your babysitter.
On July 4th, 1956, just before 3 p.m., Betty Weinberger went outside to check on her infant son. She'd set him out on the back patio in his carriage to enjoy the sun. Now, the carriage stood empty. In place of Peter was the note.
This wasn't supposed to happen to the Weinbergers. They weren't fabulously wealthy like the Lindberghs. They lived in a suburban home on Long Island like normal people. There was no reason to think their baby wouldn't be safe on their own patio.
As Betty Weinberger sank to her knees on her patio, clutching the ransom note to her breast, she wished with all her heart she had never taken her eyes off Peter.
Now, Betty and her husband Morris had to make the biggest decision of their lives. Would they follow the kidnapper's instructions and pay the ransom in secret? Or would they call the police in spite of the kidnapper's threat?
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. New episodes of Hostage come out every Thursday.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This week, we're taking you inside the kidnapping of Peter Weinberger, a 1-month-old baby stolen from his carriage in Westbury, Long Island, New York, on July 4th, 1956.
The search for baby Peter's kidnapper lasted nearly 7 weeks, leading to a massive FBI manhunt involving more than 2 million potential suspects.
The Weinberger case changed the way kidnappings were investigated in the United States. Today, we'll take you through this case from start to finish, beginning with the terrifying first hours after the Weinbergers discovered their baby was missing.
We'll also tell you how the FBI caught the desperate man who took baby Peter, and how an overeager news media may have been partly responsible for a botched ransom exchange.
Angelo LaMarca's life started out on the right track. Born on April 13, 1925, in Brooklyn, he was a talented student, making above-average grades across the board. But at age 15, he abruptly dropped out of school, citing a desire to earn money. He took a job as a counterman at a local diner.
Around the same time, young Angelo began dating, His first and only girlfriend was Donna, a young woman from a troubled background. She had been briefly placed in a Catholic home for girls by her parents, but by the time she met Angelo, she was back to living with her mother and stepfather. The devoutly religious couple forbade their daughter to go out with the older high school dropout, but Donna ignored their wishes and continued to see Angelo.
In July of 1943, a couple of months after he turned 18, Angelo was drafted into the U.S. Army. Angelo asked Donna to marry him before he reported for duty, but she refused, on the grounds that if she were his wife, she'd have to live with his father while he was deployed. This might seem like odd reasoning, but her family's strict religious beliefs did not allow for a married woman to live anywhere but her husband's home or the home of his family. So the couple waited.
Meanwhile, Angelo served in the U.S. Army during World War II. He was deployed to Camp Edwards, a military training facility in Massachusetts, but he was hardly a war hero. In fact, he went AWOL for a week in 1943 and was then court-martialed on February 17, 1944. He pled guilty.
Angelo was punished with 2 months of confinement in his barracks and a fine of $18.66, or about $270 today.
Angelo's military record wasn't exactly impressive, so he made up a better story. After the war was over, Angelo told everyone he'd landed on the beachheads of France a few days after D-Day. In fact, he wasn't deployed to England until nearly 2 months after D-Day. And he spent most of his time driving supply trucks.
Angelo also represented himself as a combat injured veteran after being honorably discharged in early 1946. He loved to tell a story about surviving a bombing by a German plane while driving a supply truck behind enemy lines. As proof, he would show people a 4-inch scar on his leg.
Curiously, he had never been awarded a Purple Heart for being seriously wounded in battle. This was probably because, as it later came out, Angelo had fallen on a picket fence as a child, leaving a 4-inch gash in exactly the location of his so-called war wound.
After Angelo returned to the United States, Donna finally agreed to marry him. They were wed on June 9, 1946, but 20-year-old Angelo had no threshold over which to carry his newlywed wife. Despite his military service, he was homeless.
Donna and Angelo moved into a semicircular, corrugated metal building outside New York City called a Quonset hut. The huts were manufactured for use as military barracks during both world wars. After World War II, some returning soldiers with nowhere else to go, like Angelo, were housed by the state in Quonset hut villages.
Angelo and his wife applied to move into a pioneering manufactured home community built specially for World War II veterans, called Levittown. They were rejected. Levittown was a strictly segregated neighborhood. At the time, in the late 1940s, Italian Americans like Angelo were not viewed as white.
With their Levittown dreams dashed, the couple instead moved into a tenement-style apartment in Brooklyn with no hot running water. There, they welcomed their first child, Vincent LaMarca.
Angelo worked as a truck driver, earning $85 per week, worth about $1,170 today. This was a pretty good salary for a high school dropout at the time, especially as his rent was just $35 a month.
Angelo and Donna saved for a home. Within a few years, they were able to afford the $1,500 down payment on a home in Brooklyn. In 1950, shortly after the couple became homeowners, Donna gave birth to their second child, Vivian.
Sadly, the LaMarcas had enough savings for a down payment, but not enough income to afford the mortgage and upkeep. The house was soon foreclosed upon. Angelo and Donna gave up on Brooklyn and moved to Huntington, New York.
There, Angelo's money troubles worsened. With money borrowed from his father, he started a gas station. But Angelo had no real sense for business and sold the station at a loss after 6 months. Then he started a car wrecking business, again with a loan from his father. That too folded quickly.
Angelo was desperate and unemployed, with two children to feed. In 1954, he began making and selling illegal alcohol. Although federal prohibition had ended in 1933, bootlegging was still a popular way to evade liquor taxes.
The young father, who failed at running two legitimate businesses, was no better at managing a criminal enterprise. He was soon arrested by the Treasury Department and charged with bootlegging. In 1955, he received a suspended sentence and a year's probation.
Following his arrest, Angelo became moody and depressed. He found occasional work as a truck driver and taxi driver, but failed to make ends meet. At the end of his rope, he planned his suicide, purchased bullets, and held the gun to his head. Praying for a swift end to his pain, Angelo pulled the trigger.
But the pistol didn't fire. In his state of deep distress, Angelo had purchased the wrong size of bullets for his gun.
Moments later, family friend Mike Felice walked in. Unaware of the bullet mix-up, Felice acted quickly to stop what he thought was an imminent suicide. Mike punched Angelo in the head, knocking him out, and took the gun.
Angelo was embarrassed and furious. In the coming days, he misdirected his anger at his wife, Donna, and blamed her for the lack of sex in their marriage. When the arguments didn't go his way, Angelo ripped off his wife's nightclothes and raped her.
At the time, New York law carried an exemption for rape within the context of marriage. Only in 1993 were such spousal exemptions withdrawn in all 50 states. So at the time, Angelo's rape of his wife was legal and wasn't reported to police. In hindsight, though, we can see this act as part of a long history of impulsive criminal behavior. From going AWOL to his short tenure as a bootlegger and poorly planned suicide attempt, it seems like poorly thought-out decisions with serious consequences were Angelo's signature.
Based on his wartime military service, his ensuing depression, chronic poor judgment, and erratic behavior, one might assume Angelo was suffering from post-traumatic stress. Paula Schnur, executive director of the National Center for PTSD, said in an interview with the Washington Post, quote, "Our conceptualization of the greatest generation is that soldiers came home and got to work. Many of them looked okay because they went to work, got married, they raised families, but it doesn't mean they didn't have PTSD."
Of course, it's equally possible that Angelo was just a mean, moody, violent person all along. According to criminal psychologist Dr. Stanton E. Samenow, author of Inside the Criminal Mind, PTSD patients are far more likely to exhibit avoidant behaviors than to lash out at others.
Dr. Samenow also writes that when considering violent behavior by a war veteran, it's critical to know what the person was like before the combat stress. Without concrete information on someone's pre-trauma conduct, it's impossible to blame their later violence on PTSD.
So we don't know exactly why Angelo became violent or exactly when that pattern started for him. But we do know that by 1956, when Angelo turned 31, criminality, dishonesty, and violence were normal for him. Debt, too, was a fixture in his life, usually thanks to his own poor financial judgment.
Instead of making changes to establish a lifestyle he could afford, on May 1st of 1965, the quasi-employed truck driver and taxi dispatcher bought a split-level house in Plainview, New York. Despite his history of foreclosure and an average monthly income of just $240, Angelo somehow obtained a mortgage of $14,700, or about $137,000 in today's dollars.
More concerningly, he borrowed $400, the equivalent of about $3,800 today, from a notorious loan shark. Angelo then immediately spent more money he didn't have, $900 for a large freezer and $500 for storm windows. Angelo tried his best to pay the loan shark back, but his checks kept bouncing.
Around the same time, Donna became pregnant again. Angelo was now in bed with a dangerous criminal, just when he was to become a father of three.
The phone rang constantly. Whenever Angelo picked up the receiver, he heard the loan shark's gruff voice on the other end of the line, threatening his family.
Terrified, Angelo developed terrible insomnia. If he did fall asleep, even the smallest sound would wake him up instantly, his heart racing. While Donna and the children were in bed, he paced the floors of the split-level house he could not afford. He tried drinking warm milk to get to sleep, but that just reminded him he owed money to the grocer, too.
By July of 1956, Angelo was not only sleepless, but unable to eat. His debts occupied his thoughts completely. He couldn't get anything done during the day. Employers complained about his work. He was on the verge of being fired.
Angelo was truly desperate. On the morning of July 4th, he tried to collect $100 he was owed by an acquaintance named Sal, but was rebuffed. Dismayed, he got into his car and began driving around aimlessly, trying to think of a way to repay his debts before harm came to his wife and children.
He found himself on Long Island, driving through suburban Westbury. Angelo slowed down as he made his way through the charming neighborhood, full of young families like his own.
On the sidewalk, he spotted a woman with dark curly hair, rocking her tiny baby in a carriage as she chatted with a friend. Something about the child reminded Angelo of the Lindbergh baby, the most famous kidnapping victim in American history. He took another lap around the block, then another.
After some time circling the neighborhood, Angelo saw the baby again, but not the mother. She had left the baby in his carriage on her rear patio to take in the sun. It was a common practice at the time, recommended by doctors.
Angelo slowed, then stopped his car. He reached for paper and a pen.
By the time he finished the ransom note, the baby was still outside alone. Angelo crept close to the house. He hadn't slept in days. He felt like a man possessed. He hadn't left the house that morning planning to kidnap a baby, but now it seemed like this child was an answer to his prayers.
Peter Weinberger, just 32 days old, didn't scream when Angelo LaMarca snatched him from his baby carriage and put the ransom note in his place.
Before he could think too much about what he'd just done, Angelo was roaring out of the sleepy Westbury neighborhood, headed for the Northern State Parkway. On the passenger seat, little Peter Weinberger slept peacefully.
In a moment, the media puts Peter in mortal danger.
And now back to the story.
Betty and Morris Weinberger were beside themselves when they discovered their infant son was gone from his carriage that sunny morning on July 4th, 1956. At first, they didn't want to believe it was real. It must be an awful prank. Surely any moment a friend would knock at the door, laughing and holding the baby. But soon, with the minutes ticking by and Peter still missing, the Weinbergers were forced to accept that Peter really had been kidnapped.
The couple debated whether or not to call the police. In the ransom note, the kidnapper had threatened to kill Peter. But if they didn't call right away, detectives would miss the opportunity to collect fresh evidence at the scene of the crime. Then the kidnapper might never be caught.
They made the call. Within minutes, the case was assigned to Sergeant Edward Curran, a 36-year-old World War II veteran and dogged investigator.
At first, just like the Weinbergers, Curran thought this couldn't be real. Only rich people's babies got kidnapped, like the Lindbergh baby.
But after hearing the shock and horror in the Weinbergers' voices, Curran knew that not only was the kidnapping real, it would be the biggest case of his young career.
Morris begged police to make sure the media didn't publish anything about the kidnapping. It could mean the end of Peter's life if the kidnapper became frightened by publicity.
Police Secretary John McDonald contacted all five major newspapers in the area to establish a media blackout. He emphasized that the life of a 32-day-old infant was at stake.
Of course, most papers immediately agreed to honor the blackout and publish nothing until the baby was safe. All but one, the New York Daily News. Instead of cooperating with police, the Daily News prepared a front-page story.
New York's five papers were fiercely competitive. With their four competitors all committed to a blackout, the story was effectively an exclusive for the New York Daily News. Even with an infant's life hanging in the balance, editors at the Daily News decided the story was too valuable to pass up.
Meanwhile, Nassau County Police knew they were out of their depth, working their very first kidnapping case. They contacted the FBI and asked for help.
But because of a law that established a 7-day waiting period before federal agents could begin investigating kidnapping cases, the FBI was unable to assist. Sergeant Curran and his team realized that by the time the FBI was able to get involved, Peter would likely be either safely at home or dead.
Unaware of the firestorm of publicity coming their way the next day, Nassau police and the Weinbergers focused on paying the ransom. The $2,000 Angelo requested in his note, worth more than $18,000 in modern currency, was more cash than the Weinbergers could lay their hands on with less than 24 hours' notice.
Working with Officer Curran, the parents decided to try a phony ransom package. It only had to look convincing enough to lure the kidnapper into picking it up.
They wrapped real banknotes around blank strips of paper and stuffed the fake money inside brown envelopes as the ransom note had requested. The hope was that the kidnapper would appear in person to collect the ransom. Then, cops watching the drop spot would arrest him and reclaim baby Peter.
It was as good a plan as any, especially for cops who had never handled a kidnapping before. And if not for the New York Daily News, it might have worked.
By the time the Weinbergers woke up on July 5th, 1956, they were on the front page of one of New York's largest newspapers. Reporters were gathered outside their home, watching their every move.
The news was truly out now. A regretful police secretary, McDonald, released the other four newspapers from their blackout promises.
Three reporters were even allowed to accompany Morris Weinberger to the drop site, following him in a separate car. The police reasoned that the reporters would interfere less if they were confined to a vehicle rather than milling around openly.
Unfortunately, there were far more than three journalists involved by now. Representatives of all five major New York papers had somehow obtained the text of the ransom note demanding the money be placed next to the signpost at the corner of Albemarle Road and Park Avenue at exactly 10 o'clock.
So at 9:55 a.m., when Morris Weinberger approached the corner of Albemarle and Park, carrying two stuffed brown paper envelopes, the streets were lousy with reporters. With no other option, he dropped the decoy packages and left the site.
Police watched from all sides. They hoped the kidnapper would be desperate enough to collect the ransom, despite the lack of privacy.
Angelo did indeed come for his money. With Peter hidden in his car, he drove slowly by the drop site.
But when he saw a crowd of reporters had gathered, he kept on driving. It was obvious there was no way to collect the ransom without being seen.
Angelo thought kidnapping this baby would be the answer to all of his money problems. $2,000 was more than enough to get the loan shark off his back. If he could just get that debt paid off, things would be okay. His family would be safe.
But now, with his crime on the front page of newspapers, Angelo found himself even more terrified than before. He wished he could go back to when he was only running from one man, rather than from the entire police department. Instead of eliminating his worries, he'd multiplied them exponentially.
So, a man with a long history of disastrously impulsive decision-making made another horrible spur-of-the-moment decision. He pulled off the Northern State Parkway at exit 37. It was a thickly wooded area in those days.
Carrying baby Peter, Angelo walked into the woods. Within less than 100 yards, the trees and brush were so dense that he could no longer see the road.
Angelo placed Peter face down in the thick underbrush. Then, before he could second-guess his choice, he turned on his heel and walked away. It was about 11:40 a.m. on July 5, 1956, less than 2 hours after the agreed-upon time for the delivery of the ransom.
Alone in the woods, just 550 feet from the nearest home and yet invisible to its occupants, 33-day-old Peter Weinberger died of exposure. Angelo was the last to see him alive, so we can't know how many hours or days Peter remained alive, frightened, suffering from cold, dehydration, and hunger before his heart stopped beating.
All we know is that Angelo cared only about himself in that moment. He could have left the baby on someone's doorstep or waited until the dead of night and dropped him anonymously in front of a police station. He could have gone to one of the houses near the place where he dropped Peter in the woods, knocked on the door, and told the occupant he'd heard a baby crying but couldn't find it.
There were so many ways for Angelo to get Peter out of his possession without leaving the child alone to die. And yet, he took the easiest possible way out.
Or, at least, that's what he thought he was doing. In reality, he was signing his own death warrant with the same hands that placed Peter face down in the dirt.
Now, Angelo's money worries returned to the front of his mind. It occurred to him that he was the only person who knew he didn't have Peter. There was no reason to stop trying to squeeze the parents for money.
Peter's parents, Betty and Morris Weinberger, were furious with the news media after Angelo didn't show up to collect his ransom. Morris publicly denounced reporters for interfering in the police investigation. They hoped for another message from the kidnapper, but as the days dragged by, further communication seemed less and less likely.
A few days after the kidnapping, Sergeant Edward Curran, the lead detective on the case, launched a massive manhunt. By now, the story had spread across America. People from coast to coast were phoning in tips, all of them dead ends.
The Weinbergers got bizarre phone calls at all hours of the night. A former mental patient named Shirley Ginsburg phoned, pretending to have Peter, and asked for a ransom.
The same ploy was also attempted by two men, also having no connection to the case. They called the Weinbergers with their ransom demands, but were quickly traced by police and arrested for extortion.
The crank calls were devastating, but far worse were seemingly legitimate tips that wasted police resources and gave the Weinbergers false hope. One of these, on July 9th, came from a New Jersey iconoclast named George Daner.
The 76-year-old Daner was infamous for his ongoing art project, a castle in Vineland, New Jersey, built out of trash. He called it the Palace of Depression. He claimed the idea for the oddball art installation came to him in a dream. Now that it was built, Daner would do anything to promote himself and the palace.
That included giving false information on an active kidnapping case. Daner called the police tip line, claiming the kidnappers were in his hometown of Vineland, New Jersey, and would accept a $5,000 ransom in exchange for Peter soon. Ever the savvy marketer, Daner refused to give details by phone.
This meant authorities would have to visit him. Daner hoped they would be trailed by reporters, who would have to photograph and report on his palace of depression. When the police showed up for their visit, Daner insisted he'd seen Peter Weinberger in a tour group at the palace.
According to Daner, Peter was carried by a young couple and cried throughout the tour. Then Daner said he offered to adopt the couple's baby for $5,000. When they hastily agreed, he felt sure he was looking at the famous kidnapped victim, Peter Weinberger.
Daner gave clear descriptions of the couple. He claimed they had agreed to return the next day and give up the baby in exchange for $5,000. Daner invited police to stay and watch this transaction, then arrest the couple.
Of course, there was absolutely no possibility Peter had ever been to the Palace of Depression. This was a cold-blooded attention grab by a shameless self-promoter. But the authorities couldn't possibly know that yet. They had no way of knowing that by July 9th, Peter Weinberger had been dead for 4 days.
In a moment, the crucial evidence that sealed Angelo's fate. And now, back to the story.
On July 10th, 6 days after the kidnapping, police resources were divided between their manhunt near the Weinbergers' home and the new investigation in Vineland, New Jersey. There was one more day left in the 7-day waiting period before the FBI could get involved and provide some much-needed relief.
Also on July 10th, Angelo called the Weinbergers at home twice. He claimed to still have Peter. In the two phone calls, he upped his ransom demand to $5,000. And unlike the extortionists posing as kidnappers, Angelo knew and provided details of the crime that hadn't been released to the media.
He also knew that Peter was probably dead, but of course he didn't mention that. Angelo told Betty and Morris Weinberger to leave $5,000 in a blue cloth bag at exit 28 off the Northern State Parkway. He only gave them 30 minutes notice before the drop-off time in an effort to reduce the likelihood they'd be followed.
Again, the Weinbergers scrambled to make their appointment with the kidnapper. Unlike with the first drop, they weren't taking any chances on phony packages. They followed his instructions right down to the part about the color of the bag.
But again, Angelo failed to collect the ransom. At the drop point, a piece of twine led police to some discarded automobile seat covers. Tucked away underneath them was a second note from the kidnapper.
It read in its entirety, "If everything goes smooth, the baby will be left wrapped in an army blanket and placed at the exit of the parkway closest to your house in exactly 1 hour. Your babysitter."
Obviously, everything did not go smooth. The world's worst babysitter never showed up at the second drop point. After watching for hours, the police and the Weinbergers recovered the untouched blue bag.
On July 11th, finally, the FBI could enter the case. They'd had a week to prepare their strategy, so they moved fast. A new FBI field office was opened on Long Island just to deal with the Weinberger kidnapping.
Agents were also dispatched to Vineland, New Jersey, where they interviewed George Daner. Under pressure from the FBI's expert interrogators, Daner admitted he'd made the entire thing up.
Daner was already well known in Vineland for his bizarre palace, but now he became locally notorious for interfering with the Weinberger investigation. Local papers wrote editorials angrily denouncing him and urging residents to stay far away from the Palace of Depression.
Meanwhile, on Long Island, FBI agents convinced the Weinbergers to make a widespread public appeal for the return of their son, covering television, radio, and print outlets.
On July 11th, a United Press story appeared quoting Betty Weinberger as saying Peter needed a special milk formula and a vitamin supplement to survive. It's unclear whether this was true or just an idea cooked up by the FBI to scare the kidnapper into returning Peter.
Betty Weinberger also gave an emotional televised interview on a news program called The 11th Hour. As viewers across America watched, the desperate mother broke down in tears and begged for her baby boy's safe return.
Betty pleaded with the unknown kidnapper, saying, "Whoever you are, please return my baby who needs me. I assume you are desperately in need of money, and I'm willing to cooperate in any way to get my baby back. Call anyone. Leave notes any place. Help me."
It was a gut-wrenching interview. Betty was clearly on the verge of collapse.
We can only guess at how Angelo felt when he watched Betty's TV interview. Perhaps he was able on some level to empathize with Betty, especially as he watched his own wife, Donna, prepare for their third child.
But whatever he might have felt towards Betty, Angelo kept silent.
Meanwhile, the FBI narrowed in on their first real big clue in the case. It was in the two ransom notes. They both shared a strange quirk. The cursive M's were written like Z's. This was so unusual that, in combination with a few other handwriting oddities, the G-men felt sure they could positively identify the kidnapper if they could just obtain a matching handwriting sample.
This handwriting sample became the FBI's new primary focus in the case.
Dedicated FBI agents examined records at the Department of Motor Vehicles. They visited schools, offices, city governments, municipal facilities, even aircraft plants, looking at every example of cursive script that they could find.
The agents working the case came up with a boilerplate message that used all the letters they felt were unusual in the ransom notes, including the odd M. Whenever a person with similar handwriting was identified, he was brought in and asked to copy down an innocuous-seeming message.
Handwriting analysis may seem like a pretty slow way to find a suspect, but in the era before DNA evidence, it was the best option. And they were lucky to have such an unusual handwriting sample. As the days and weeks passed, word of the search spread among the law enforcement agencies around the state.
On August 22, 1956, a probation officer working in Brooklyn called the FBI. The PO had just reviewed the file of a man who was finishing up his probation after being arrested for illegally operating a moonshine still in Suffolk County. The man's handwriting was peculiar, particularly the way he tilted his M's so they could have been mistaken for Z's.
Almost 7 weeks after Peter Weinberger was kidnapped, the FBI first heard the name Angelo LaMarca. They arrested him the next day, on August 23rd, in front of his wife and children.
Like the previous suspects police had hauled in, Angelo was asked first for a handwriting sample. He copied down the message given to him by the FBI. His handwriting was a perfect match to the ransom notes. 16 different letters had unique characteristics, all of which were identical to the notes.
Agents confronted Angelo with the ransom notes, but rather than immediately confessing, Angelo came up with a ridiculous story. As a joke with friends, he claimed he'd written out several silly ransom notes, then discarded them in a wastebasket. Some other person, definitely not Angelo, must have retrieved them and used them in a real kidnapping.
Just a completely normal pastime with your friends, writing fake ransom notes threatening to kill children. Angelo must have known how terrible his lie was, but he still refused to open up.
That was until Sergeant Edward Curran showed up. The FBI had all but taken over Nassau County's investigation, and they'd done a good job, running a search that only a federal organization could possibly run. In the final tally, FBI agents reviewed more than 2 million writing samples.
But when it came to getting a working-class New Yorker to confess, Sergeant Curran knew no buttoned-up federal agent in a suit could do what he could. Curran showed up at the FBI's New York headquarters in Manhattan and made a scene until he was finally allowed to interrogate the prisoner.
Alone with Angelo LaMarca, Sergeant Curran used one of the most effective interrogation tactics in the book, empathy. According to a 1997 report in Esquire magazine, Curran even described himself as being on the kidnapper's side.
Curran told Angelo, "I am the only friend you have. I am Elmont born. I live on the same street as your parents. These guys are looking to screw you. Start talking now, because if it's up to J. Edgar Hoover, well, he'll put you in the chair."
While that softened Angelo up some, it didn't loosen his lips. Curran ordered the FBI agent outside to bring Donna into the room. She was still heavily pregnant. Donna LaMarca began to scream at her husband, demanding that he tell her if he'd stolen a baby or not.
Angelo was undone, finally. He begged police to take his wife away. When they did, he finally broke down and began to tell the truth.
Well, a version of the truth. According to later court transcripts, Angelo told several stories that minimized his involvement in the kidnapping at first. In the first version of his story, Angelo merely stayed in the car while a shady fellow connected with his loan shark kidnapped Peter Weinberger.
When police countered that Angelo's fingerprints were found on the carriage, Angelo changed his story to say that he'd accompanied the real kidnapper onto the porch, but never touched the baby. He claimed to have only lifted the mosquito netting on the carriage so his acquaintance could steal the baby.
Although he still tried to pin the blame on an accomplice, Angelo did tell the truth about one thing. In the early evening on August 23rd, 1956, Angelo signed a formal confession stating, "The baby was left, still alive, in the bushes by exit 37 on Northern State Parkway about 11:40 a.m., July 5th, 1956.
Police immediately took Angelo to the area and asked him to point to the exact spot where he left Peter. Meanwhile, the Weinbergers were notified of the new development in their son's case.
Tragically, Betty Weinberger still had hope, even after hearing that her son was left face down in the woods. She made a statement to the media begging anyone who had found a baby near exit 37 to come forward. She hoped someone had been caring for Peter as if he were their own.
Police had to call off the search for Peter temporarily at nightfall, but they returned the next morning with enough manpower to conduct a thorough, gridded search of the area.
Soon, one of the officers found something. A diaper pin.
As he looked closer, he realized the diaper pin was still attached to what was left of a cloth diaper. That diaper was still wrapped around the decomposing remains of an infant. After 51 long days, Peter Weinberger was found.
Betty and Morris would never hold their son again, but at least they had some grisly semblance of closure. That was small consolation for two parents who just the day before had still hoped to find their son alive in the loving arms of a surrogate mother.
The manhunt was over. The search for Peter was over. The only thing left was to make sure Peter's kidnapper paid the highest possible price for his callous actions.
Angelo never crossed state lines with Peter, so there were no federal charges. Nassau County authorities would have to prosecute the case without the FBI's massive resources. They began to prepare for the biggest case of their lives.
Meanwhile, the federal agents involved in the case were unsatisfied with the result. They felt hamstrung by the 7-day waiting period. If their search began sooner, it might not have saved Peter's life, but then again, it might have. A medical expert said Peter might have survived for as long as a week in the woods.
Under pressure from both the public and the FBI, the U.S. Congress passed legislation modifying the Federal Kidnapping Act to allow the FBI to investigate kidnapping cases after just 24 hours. On August 6th of 1956, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed the bill, writing it into federal law.
Never again would parents of missing kids have to wait out a torturous week before federal resources could be brought into play to find their children.
Angelo's trial on charges of kidnapping and murder began in November of 1956. He pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity.
A defense psychiatrist testified that while Angelo knew what he was doing when he took Peter, it was nevertheless a symptom of previously undiagnosed mental illness. He claimed that Angelo no longer even remembered the kidnapping and was unsure if his own stories were true or not.
The jury, composed of 10 fathers and 2 grandfathers, was unconvinced. Angelo held a job, worked consistently, and managed to care for his family during this time when he was supposedly too mentally ill to know that abandoning an infant to die in the woods was wrong.
On December 14, 1956, the jury returned a guilty verdict and declined to recommend leniency. Under state law at the time, such a verdict on a charge of murder meant an automatic death sentence. In the gallery, Morris and Betty Weinberger collapsed into each other's arms.
A series of appeals, all the way up to the Supreme Court, delayed Angelo's execution for nearly 2 years. But Angelo lost each of his appeals. On August 7th, 1958, Angelo Lamarca was executed at Sing Sing Prison.
The execution of the perpetrator would be the end of most true crime stories, but this one has an unusual postscript.
Angelo's son, Vincent, was 11 years old when his father was executed. Although he loved his father and treasured the letters he'd sent from death row, Vincent also sympathized deeply with the Weinberger family.
Following Angelo's execution, a local reporter wrote a story about the Lamarca family, left destitute without their provider. Gifts from strangers began to arrive in the mail. $5 here, a winter coat there. It was enough to get Donna and her children back on their feet.
Some of the gifts came from the Nassau County Police Department. Over time, the same investigators who had worked the Weinberger case became like a band of surrogate fathers to Vincent and Vivian.
Vincent later remembered his surprise at receiving such generosity, telling Esquire reporter Mike McAllery in 1997, quote, "I was shamed and embarrassed. The kindness of the cops and strangers was astounding."
After moving to Long Beach, New York, Vincent Lamarca became a police officer, serving for 20 years. He was, by all accounts, an excellent investigator.
Yet, in a sad twist of fate, in 1996, Vincent was notified that his estranged son, Joey, stood charged with murder. The sad story of a man sandwiched between his father's crime and his son's became the basis of the film City by the Sea. Robert De Niro played Vincent opposite a young James Franco as Joey.
Joey's crime, like Angelo's, was an impulsive and desperate one. Joey, like Angelo, dropped out of school at 15, and, like Angelo, Joey signed his name with a cursive M that tilts onto its side, looking like a Z.
Some people think murder runs in families. One of those people is Joey Lamarca. In a jailhouse interview, he expounded on his theory about his crimes.
Joey said, quote, "The disease is in my mind. My grandfather had it too. It just lays there, waiting to develop and take over your body. I never read Angelo's death row letters, but I would have liked to. Maybe I could have understood my mental illness better."
Perhaps Joey's right. In Sicilian, the name Lamarca means the mark. Maybe Angelo was somehow marked with a genetic propensity to murder, one that skipped Vincent's generation and was passed down to Joey.
But Vincent, the now retired policeman, took a different view. The way he saw it, the difference between himself, his father, and his murderous son boils down to one simple thing. All three had free will, and they made different choices.
Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We will be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. Hostage is written by Yelena Waugh and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.